It's Tuesday afternoon, and it's time for the Tuesday afternoon Surviving the Future Book Club, Surviving the Future Culture Carnival and Capital in the Aftermath of the Market Economy. Is a remarkable book distilled from David Fleming's Lean Logic, edited by Sean Chamberlain. And by permission of Sean Chamberlain and Chelsea Green Publishing, they've been allowing us to air the audiobook chapter by chapter each Tuesday afternoon. Peter Buffett.
Jimmy Buff.
How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right. Not too bad. I read a review of a book that I love some years ago, stunning piece of work called Winter's Tale by a guy named Mark Halperin. And the guy who reviewed it originally for the New York Times when the book came out in the early 1980s said that he was fearful of not doing the work justice in his review.
Hmm.
And that's sometimes how I feel airing these chapters from Surviving the Future.
Me too. That's so funny, because I was coming in today and thinking, you know, we always say a little something here and there before, and of course more after we'd listen to the chapter. And I think, and every week I'd leave feeling like I could have done better somehow, because what's in here is so big and deep and wide and important, and it's just us talking afterwards.
But, you know, that's and in the relationship of the world, as the world gets crazier and crazier, despite the blue swell last Tuesday,
right.
You know, the House of Representatives is going to be democratically controlled come January. Despite all that, there's just so much going on. Climate change just seems irrevocable, that we're marching towards this destiny. The wildfires in California, a direct result of that.
Yep.
And it becomes all the more important to heed the call of what's being talked about in this book, right?
Right, because, you know, after the election last week, it was all about that, and people saying, well, what do you think? And it's, and I think I said this on last week's show, the arc is so much longer than an election cycle or a generation or even a couple of centuries. We're in something, I say it often, Wes Jackson, you know, we're a species out of context. We are a species out of context. This is a arc that could be hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years long. And we're not doing such a good job right now, but we haven't been here that long. And I think that's important to remember.
Right. And the idea of permanence that a lot of, you know, Homo sapiens today think that they have, it's really not accurate.
Not at all.
Yeah.
No.
So, well, with that said, let's listen to Chapter 7 and then we'll talk more afterwards.
Excellent.
Chapter 7, Needs and Wants. A distinction between needs and wants has been made by many critics in the Green Movement and its predecessors, who have argued that consumption in response to our needs is justifiable and sustainable, but consumption in response to our wants is not. The American economist Thorstein Veblen, 1857 to 1929, insisted that the desire to satisfy wants had but one overriding explanation: conspicuous consumption. Wants, Veblen tells us, are manifested in unnecessary things, like decoration, what he called architectural distress in the case of buildings, and in such pointless symbols of an idle and wasted life as flowers, cats and dogs, sports and higher learning. Such conspicuous consumption, he tells us, has no practical value for human life and well-being. Its purpose is simply to impress, to intimidate, and to provide evidence that the consumer is lucky enough to not have to do a full day's work and so can exploit other people's toil. Once people have felt the buzz of material excess, it develops an addictive hold over them, as powerful as that of alcohol. So, that leaves needs. And what are they? The utopian Marxist Herbert Marcuse, 1898 to 1979, explains: the only needs that have an unqualified claim for satisfaction are the vital ones: nourishment, clothing, lodging. This distinction between needs and wants became an issue of even greater concern when people started to realize that the high levels of consumption enjoyed in the market economy are too great to be sustained by the environment. Evidently, consumption must be cut back. Envy must be slain. Wants must go. Needs can stay. Needs, wrote Duane Elgin in 1981, are those things that are essential to our survival and growth. Wants are those things that are extra, that gratify our psychological desires. And to indulge wants is a bad thing, reducing the vastness of who we are to a mask, an image, an ill-fitting shell. Mahatma Gandhi and E.F. Schumacher, quoting him, came close to a simple equation of need and greed. Earth provides enough to satisfy every man's need, but not for every man's greed. Jeremy Seabrook's view of the commodities that reflect wants rather than needs has been consistently blistering. They are akin to heroin, addictive and alienated from human need, and people are goaded into thinking they want them by the vast and abstract power of capital. Need has been turned against life. And the responsibility for much of this was down to industry, as Kenneth Galbraith explained. Producers, he wrote, create wants along with the goods to satisfy them, like the town doctor deftly knocking over pedestrians with his car in order to keep the town hospital full. Since these wants are synthesized by advertising, catalyzed by salesmanship, and shaped by the discreet manipulations of the persuaders, which itself shows that they cannot be very urgent, consumers find themselves on a mad squirrel wheel of ever-increasing, ever-unsatisfied desire. Now, one thing to be noted about this critique is that it does not care about the nature of psychological desires. All that really matters is the means which are used to satisfy them. None but the most extreme critic, such as Veblen, really has any objection to wants, so long as they are of a kind which non-material, or not too obviously material, means can satisfy. Poetry, conversation, and dancing, it seems, are all right, as are approved occupations such as thinking, singing, laughing, reading books from the public library, interactive electronic entertainment, hiking, painting, and playing cards. The behaviour that causes the problem is the use of material means for psychological ends, especially if those ends are suspected of being related to social status. If people had a true understanding of what makes them happy and of what their real needs are, they would keep their material requirements down to an uncluttered, physiological minimum. They might, with Henry David Thoreau, be content to derive a real vigour from the scent of the gale wafted over the naked ground, as from strong meats, and realise again how man is the pensioner of nature. From this point of view, the austere repudiation of wants is claimed to be the road to enlightenment. And yet, this distaste for material goods will not do as a response to the market economy's material intemperance. The sound of your hammer at 5 in the morning or 8 at night, heard by a creditor, makes him easy 6 months longer. But if he sees you at a billiard table or hears your voice at a tavern when you should be at work, he sends for his money the next day. This is from Benjamin Franklin's Puritan Credo, whose first instruction is, remember that time is money. All work and no unnecessary expenditure is a recipe for getting rich. At first sight, it might also seem to be in conflict with the Christian ideal of poverty, but, as Max Weber explains, the Puritans were able to see money as a sign of God's blessing and at the same time the most evident proof of rebirth and genuine faith. Here is the confused, if competent, John Wesley struggling with this problem. I fear wherever riches have increased, the essence of religion has decreased in the same proportion. Therefore, I do not see how it is possible, in the nature of things, for any revival of true religion to continue long. Is there no way to prevent this continual decay of pure religion? His answer is heroic. We ought not to prevent people from being diligent and frugal. We must exhort all Christians to gain all they can and to save all they can, that is, in effect, to grow rich. He thought there was nothing inconsistent about making goods for other people, while, for himself, his family and his co-workers, there was little comfort and little time to enjoy the money he made. The formula was certainly effective. The Puritan states of New England raced ahead of the different traditions in Rhode Island and the South in their early economic development. But the legacy of this, as Tibor Skitovsky writes, is Puritan money-mindedness, distrust of all artifice aimed merely to enhance enjoyment, and an acceptance of dull food and drab surroundings. This joyless economy cultivates a disdain for the knowledge required to cope with culture. It presses for the progressive crowding out of a liberal humanistic education by the requirements of science and technology, and, faced with boredom, prefers quick kicks to the reflective skills required for culture. Culture, the learning of the leisure class, writes Skidovsky, became distrusted and disliked. To the Puritans, skills and learning aimed solely at enhancing one's ability to obtain enjoyment looked like instruments of the devil. For pre-market societies, by contrast, goods had a significance which extended well beyond their functions as instruments for a practical purpose. Agricultural implements, household goods and weapons, along with houses, churches, fields and wells, were decorated, blessed, and given names. A healthy delight in goods, what Mary Douglas and Baron Isherwood call the visible part of culture, is a characteristic alike of jackdaws and of enduring societies. And a regard for goods, which assigns them a value beyond their instrumental function and pretends they have a life of their own, is not wholly unconnected with a regard for people. Neither the careful concern for the chattels of the 18th century household described by the historian Margaret Vicary, nor the consuming interest in accumulated household goods demonstrated by the Dodson women in George Eliot's The Mill on the Floss, were cases of gullible and greedy acquiescence to clever advertising. The pleasure they took from the company of the meticulously pressed linen and from the artifacts of their households is frank and refreshing. And, in some cases at least, there was no visible join between their concern for their household's goods and their concern for its people. In this sense, the modern market economy is less materialistic than those traditional societies for which goods and their conspicuous display were central to festival and culture, over and above providing for subsistence. Along with all other forms of communication, goods, in all their extravagance and unnecessariness, drew the lines of social relationships. As the anthropologists Douglas and Isherwood write, "Forget the idea of consumer irrationality. Forget that commodities are good for eating, clothing, and shelter. Forget their usefulness. And try instead the idea that commodities are good for thinking. Treat them as a non-verbal medium for the human creative faculty. A person's possession of material goods tells you something about him or her. In most societies until the late market economy, they elaborately communicated, among other things, social status, particular loyalties, obligations, and belonging. Before the 19th century, a central concern of clothing, though not an entirely serious concern because play was integrated into it, was to act as such a signal. But the arrival of the weariness, fever, and fret of the dirty and dislocated industrial market changed all that. Dress promptly responded to that horror by turning to black, both because conformity and anonymity became commercial assets, and because it disguised the soot. In the market economy, the signals given out by goods are much weaker. But this is not a concern because social roles are substantially replaced by money exchange. It does not matter who you are so long as your money is good. Goods in our culture are losing, to some extent, their implicit functions, the symbolism, the social function which ought to travel with them. They are becoming, in a sense, invisible. Here are some examples. Food, in addition to its overt function of providing nutrition, also has, or had, an implicit function in reciprocal giving and in the daily interaction around a table, without which the durability of the household in any structured sense is improbable. The implicit function of clothes as signals of social belonging, courtesy, and standing has waned. Sport has lost much of its implicit but crucial function of ceremony and play, and is left with the overt but futile business of winning. Perhaps sex has lost a bit of its implicit function in cementing relationships and is becoming a simpler, reduced proposition. Paradoxically, we consume in great quantities, but aren't entirely comfortable with actually taking enjoyment in that consumption. Often there is some guilt in there, a tendency to explain fulfilled desires away as needs for which we had little reasonable alternative. There is a hesitation to celebrate goods as material artifacts in their own right. The effect of this disenchantment, this denial of the spirit and deeper significance of the currency of goods, services, and behaviour, is to make it harder to recall anything about them at all. The object was eaten, worn, contested, or had, but the implicit function, which is the only bit that engages the mind, emotions, and spirit, probably did not happen at all. And if it did, you must have blinked at the wrong moment. Goods are finally becoming instrumentalized, increasingly invisible except for their instrumental purpose. Austerity, in a sense, is upon us ahead of schedule. But, in the absence of an efficiently functioning market, the identity of the person you are dealing with will be important again. Each party has to be sure that the other one can be reliably identified, that he will deliver when the debt is called in, that he is a willing participant in the society and its culture, and that he is happy to show it. And for signals to work in this way, another need will become evident: constrained diversity. The ability of signals to convey nuance and meaning depends on their being contained within a limited range, with an implied or explicit grammar and vocabulary. If the diversity is too great, it foregoes its grammar and ceases to communicate. It is merely off the scale. For example, the gross strangeness, from the Greek's point of view, of the clothing worn by the Roman negotiators at the city of Tarentum in the 3rd century BC was too different to be intelligible. For the Greeks, those billowing togas had nothing to say, gesture without meaning, and had them falling about with laughter. The negotiators took a huff and went home. Then there was war. In the lean economy, effective signals of identity, of good faith, of availability will be needed. Goods will have to work hard again to say something. And here is an intention. What they will say in the lean economy is that every place is a sacred place. Every ecology has its enchantment, its quiet music, its authority. At the very least, every town and village will need to be visible and communicative. Places will have a meaning, giving signals of particular loyalties, of rooted obligations and belonging, of a cultural landscape. Public places and private houses will live up to the standards of the urban designer Francis Tibbles' 10th commandment: "Thou shalt, with all the means available, promote intricacy, joy, and visual delight in the built environment." This will do as an aim for the local lean economy, whose inhabitants will have the confidence to be robustly materialist, fond of things, public and private, including attributes such as decoration, which, through having least practical value, are able to give the strongest signals. The lean economy will be comfortable with material possession in a way that the market economy would envy. Want not, waste not? The notion that needs are good and wants bad does not survive inspection. For Douglas and Isherwood, it is a curious moral split that appears under the surface of most economists' thoughts on human needs. Indeed, Surviving the Future argues that those economists may have it somewhat back to front. The heaviest burden of the modern economy by far is that imposed by its own elaborations. Any large-scale economy requires massive infrastructures and material flows just to support itself and keep existing. This intermediate economy has massively multiplied our needs. Intermediate goods are regrettable necessities. An example is defensive expenditure, the purchase or provision of goods and services such as ambulances and burglar alarms, which are intended to offset harm rather than to positively enhance well-being. Regardless of whether we want them, we need the alarms, sewage systems, heavy goods transport, police forces. Given the substantial scale of the task of feeding, raising and schooling a suburban family, and the increasing challenge of such routine needs as finding a post office, many of us undoubtedly need cars. The collapse of local self-reliance was both the cause and the effect of the massive elaboration of transport, and when that need is no longer met, its life-sustaining function will be bitterly recognised. It is then the elaboration of needs by large-scale industrial life that causes the trouble. Our wants are squeezed out, much missed and light by comparison, not least because they often involve labour-intensive crafts and services. Pianists, craftsmen, dressmakers, waitresses, gardeners with minimum environmental impact. Some wants are also needs, of course, and they cannot be cleanly separated. But if we focus our efforts on finding ways, under the stresses of the climacteric, of achieving a substantial and rapid liquidation of our needs, we will be getting somewhere. To do that, we need to understand the importance of scale.
That's chapter 7 of Surviving the Future, Culture, Carnival, and Capital in the Aftermath of the Marcus Economy. There was a moment towards the end, I'm just trying to find the line, where the idea that wants are bad and needs are good is inherently wrong with such good news.
Right. Yes, that chapter, it just has so much in it that to mine, because we really have become a pretty either needy or wanting culture, depending on how you frame it. And it really did unfold during the 19th century and 20th, really the 20th, because it went from, you know, we suddenly had this large ability to produce and manufacture, and it had to be fed. And the way it was fed, of course, is first just by creating things that were once luxuries and became necessities. And that shift started with really, you know, quality goods that mattered to people. Take shoes, you know, at first it was buy these shoes, they'll last long, they're comfortable, they're well made, they're, you know, made of this material and all that. And then it became buy shoes, it'll make you happier, your friends will like you more. It shifted from a qualitative thing to just a narcissistic thing. and people bought it. People bought it, and it's just been exploding ever since, probably from the 20s and 30s onward, to this point where nothing, and he said it so well in there in a couple different ways, but essentially nothing has a soul to it anymore. It's pardon the pun with the foot thing, the shoe thing, but there's no soul imbued into the material. And that's why, again, materialism isn't bad. It's what lives inside the material that makes you, feel that it's nearly sacred, you know, that it means something, that you pass it down, and now we just throw it away and get the latest version.
I think what strikes me too about this chapter is that Puritan model of amass all you can, but keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
That hoard it thing.
Yep. Yep.
But people like that often would indulge on something to display their status.
Right.
Right?
Yep. Yep.
Making people who didn't have that envious and create a desire, an unhealthy desire. And what I get a lot out of this chapter is that in its proper place, this stuff, the wants are very important to the human experience. And we try and deny them. And then in this day and age, we have so much wealth concentrated in the hands of so few people. And we're told that, if you work hard, you can attain this. But the oftentimes, you know, that myth of if you work as hard as you can get all you can. It's just not true.
No, it's just a carrot so that the people that do have the production power can keep producing.
Yeah.
So, and you know, it's interesting too, because I look back and I think, well, indigenous cultures here, the Egyptians, throughout time, there has been adornment and an admiration for fine products and that sort of thing in various shapes and sizes. But again, there was a different relationship to what it meant and what was imbued in those things. And it wasn't just, driven by envy and I want that and jealousy. It was a certain sacredness, again, and necessity for beauty, really. And that's lost.
And again, so essential to the human experience is the expression of beauty.
Right.
When in this chapter, they talk about that the architect who talks about when you create something, that his 10th commandment is to create with beauty and right. art and flourish.
Right.
And
right.
There's nothing wrong, I think, in being able to do that or to being able to appreciate that.
Right. And wanting to share it. I have a friend who came into great wealth. He came from a very difficult background. And so he'd buy some really amazing car. I don't remember what it was. And he'd be at a stoplight and somebody would be looking at it. And he would literally say, do you want to drive this? Take it around the block. You know, I mean, he wanted to share in the joy of having this thing. He didn't want to say, look at me, how special I am. It's like, great. You want to play with it? Come on.
Yeah. And that actually ties into one of the phrases that I sort of made a note about in this chapter, which is the joyless economy.
Yeah.
You know,
indeed.
What's the reason,
right.
then,
yeah,
right?
Right.
What's the reason? You know, the description of people who went from wearing clothes that expressed joy to wearing all black in the Industrial Revolution because it was such a joyless experience and camouflaged the soot.
Yep, yep. And when I went to Monrovia, Liberia, where, you know, the level of what we would call poverty and struggle every day is so strong. Everyone's in bright colors and has a smile on their face. Now, that's not to say that's a pleasant experience, but they're getting up every day saying, I'm going to meet this day, I'm going to do what I need to do, and I'm going to exude a certain, again, kind of joyfulness or willingness to say, it's another day and I'm happy I'm alive. And then you come back to New York and everyone's in black.
Right.
It's quite stunning, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And you see that in cultures around the world in their expression of joy through the colors of their finery, of their clothing, right. of the paintings. They're, you know, going back, you know, hundreds of thousands of years or far back to where the first cave paintings began,
right.
not quite
right.
that far.
Right.
But there's color and there's
right.
expression
right.
of joy because another note I took during this chapter was the denial of such human desires, right?
Right.
And
right.
when you deny
right. Right.
human desires, you end up with a soul sickness.
Right, exactly. And what I think we've done over this last century or so is created a wanting for things so great that can never be met, like you're saying, that the desire it ends up being soul-sucking,
yeah.
essentially.
I've been noticing in the past few days that the war on Christmas is being waged by car companies.
Right. I saw that, yeah.
I spent a little time with my son this past weekend watching some cable television, watching a superhero movie on cable TV.
Right.
We were actually watching car commercials interrupted by...
Right, yeah, 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 exactly. By
the proportion is vastly different. But, you know, selling cars as a Christmas gift to people who can't afford a car.
Wow.
And these are all high-ends. You know, it's Mercedes and it's
wow.
Audi. Honda, a fairly affordable brand, actually right. uses the phrase, happy Honda days.
Oh.
So if people really want to see where the war
right.
on Christmas and commercialism right. is really playing into it, it's in places yeah. like that. It's not in people who are upset because they have to say happy holidays instead of Merry
right.
Christmas.
Right.
That's not where the war is being fought.
Absolutely not. Yeah, that's incredible. And that speaks a little bit to another thing I was struck by in terms of needs when he was saying food, clothing, and shelter. And of course, a car would fall into that in this culture. But the food and clothing in particular, I was so struck by how we need those things. And yet now the production of those things for most people takes on a very dark, really egregious tone in terms of who's doing the work. So in other words, you go to Target, you go to whatever the other stores are where there's super cheap clothes. And where are those coming from? They're coming from Bangladesh. They're coming from people that are being destroyed by the creation of those needs. Same with the food. You follow your bacon and lettuce and tomato sandwich back to the fields, and you have got egregious behavior in terms of how people are treated, what their work hours are, you know, all these things. And so our very fundamental needs are being sourced by really, you know, companies that allow this behavior, and we don't see that. We just get the food on the table, and that's all that matters to us. But how that food gets here is rotten to the core.
And in sort of spreading the idea that wants are okay in relation to needs as well, right, to a local economy, to a group of people who may not have access to that, can be resolved in sort of some of the carnival aspect of things, right? Where people can celebrate with good food. One of the things that irks me most, and I've got a lot of them, but this is near the top, is the people who look down on people getting food stamps, supplemental nutrition assistance program, SNAP is what it's called, but people who, and then chastising those people for buying lobster.
Right.
As if, you know, you're so far down on the...
You don't deserve to have a fine experience.
Right. You don't deserve to have a want.
Yeah. Yeah.
You get, you know, what's the phrase? Beggars can't be choosers, right?
Yeah.
You don't get to have wants.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, again, a wonderful, wonderful chapter that page by page could be unpacked instead of in its entirety. Paragraphs could be.
Oh, my God, stop.
Right.
really, really important.
But next week we move on to chapter 8 and a topic that you love to talk about, scale.
Scale. Yes, my favorite. My favorite, which is all about what we're doing right here.
We'll see you next Tuesday.
Thanks.